Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this Saturday? Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at wliw.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. Well, the third major on the men's calendar being played on Pinehurst number 2. And it's the fourth U.S. Open here in Pinehurst in North Carolina. And I've had the pleasure of covering all four of them here at what they call the cradle of American golf. I'll never forget the first one, the 1999 U.S. Open, the first U.S. Open played here at Pinehurst when 42-year-old Payne Stewart and Phil Mickelson duked it out in the finishing holes. Remember on that par 317th, Payne Stewart stuck his 6-iron to 4 feet of the pin, and then Phil fired his 7-iron to within 6 feet of the hole, and the roars were as loud as they get as the two came to the 18th. And then on the 18th, Payne Stewart made an 18-footer for par to win. It was Father's Day. He won his second U.S. Open title, obviously avoiding a Monday playoff, which a lot of people thought would happen back then. And after draining the putt for the win, he went over to Phil Mickelson and shook his hand. And Phil had been wearing a beeper all week and had vowed to head back to Scottsdale, Arizona, if his wife Amy was going into labor. But that did not happen. It was close, but it didn't happen. But I remember after Payne Stewart won, he shook Phil's hand and went over to him and said, in quotes, "Nothing beats becoming a father." It was a very, very incredible quote at that time. And Amy Mickelson, Phil's wife, was home in Scottsdale, as I mentioned, about to go into labor with the birth of their first child. And then you had the victory pose, the Payne Stewart, you know, with his right arm extended and his left leg extended backwards, and that pose now immortalized at Pinehurst with the Statue of Payne. And that's right behind the 18th green. And actually, they moved it to the entranceway for the U.S. Open so more and more people could see it as they entered, as a tribute to the great Payne Stewart, who 4 months later tragically perished in a plane crash. It was just terrible. I was in Lanai on the island, one of the islands of Hawaii at the time, with a lot of PJ Tour players who knew Payne Stewart very, very well. And we were watching the news and seeing just the tragedy unfold. It was just crazy. And that all was 25 years ago. Well, the U.S. Open at Pinehurst in 2005 was much less dramatic. Michael Campbell of New Zealand was the surprise winner. And then in 2014, Martin Keimer of Germany won. And a week later, Michelle Wee won the U.S. Women's Open on the same course. It was special to have the U.S. Open and the U.S. Women's Open at Pinehurst on back-to-back weeks back then. Well, the World Golf Hall of Fame has returned to Pinehurst, where it originally opened back in 1974. It had moved in 1998 to St. Augustine, Florida, but recently returned to Pinehurst and is now a part of the USGA's Golf House Pinehurst, a 7-acre campus located near the Pinehurst Resort and Country Club's main clubhouse. So it's great to have it back here in Pinehurst, where it will get a lot more play and where, you know, all kinds of people will be able to come and enjoy everything in the World Golf Hall of Fame. They had a wonderful Hall of Fame inductions as part of the U.S. Open week, and I was thrilled for Padraig Harrington of Ireland on his induction, 3-time major champion, 6-time Ryder Cup player. Padraig is in my book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. He's one of the 6 male legends that I write about in the book, and he shares just incredible insight and revelations about how he approaches golf and life, mostly about life wisdom. Sandra Palmer was inducted as well, winner of 28 titles, including two majors. And Grammy Award winner, singer-songwriter Anne Murray actually introduced her. And I interviewed Anne Murray years ago in Vegas for my Golf Channel show, Conversations with Anne Liguori. So it was great to see Anne Murray after all those years. The late Tom Weisskopf, winner of 16 PGA Tour titles, including the 1973 Open Championship. He got in as well. Johnny Farrell, who won the U.S. Open in 1928 and was born in White Plains, New York, he got inducted, as well as three-time major winner Beverly Hansen. And the 13 founders of the LPGA were also inducted. About time. It was great to see that happen, the 13 founders of the LPGA. Well, in this show, we're going to talk more about the World Golf Hall of Fame and the induction ceremony with Martin Davis, golf historian and publisher, and about Johnny Farrell's induction into the Hall, as Martin Davis played a little role in that. And Julia Pine of the USGA will fill us in on what departments of the USGA have moved to Pinehurst from New Jersey and are now headquartered here at Pinehurst. Hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. I am at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, my fourth U.S. Open here at Pinehurst. And it is my pleasure to welcome in Martin Davis, who owns a company called The American Golfer. He publishes beautiful coffee table books, his latest, Arnold Palmer, American Hero. He also is a writer, editor, publisher. I've known Martin for years. We're both on the board of the Met Golf Writers Association, and it's been a longtime friend and colleague. It's always a pleasure to welcome in Martin Davis. Hey, Marty, what's going on?
Hi, Annie. How are you?
Good. And last night was just a wonderful program. It was the World Golf Hall of Fame inductions. And first of all, let's talk about the fact that the World Golf Hall of Fame has moved back to Pinehurst. A lot of people don't realize that it was originally here in Pinehurst, North Carolina, but then it went to St. Augustine in Florida, and just recently moved back here to Pinehurst as the USGA is moving more and more departments from New Jersey to Pinehurst. And this is really the best spot for the World Golf Hall of Fame, don't you think?
It certainly is. The original Hall of Fame that was here was like 74, 75 when they established it as the World Golf Hall of Fame. And they just weren't getting the attendance. Nobody was coming, and the hotel was not certainly in the shape that it is now, and the whole Pinehurst area. But it's improved. So they moved it to St. Augustine, and it was there for 25 years now. And it was a huge building. And now they've moved it back here, and they've really gone back to what is the essence of what the Hall of Fame is. They weren't getting the attendance either in St. Augustine because it was sort of a drive-by attendance. They were hoping to catch the snowbirds right off of 95. That just didn't work out. So they decided to move it back here, and Pinehurst now is a destination in and of itself. People come here for golf, and then they've turned the hall into the essence of what it was originally established for, was to be a hall of people, of the members. So now, even though the physical footprint is smaller in size, it concentrates on each member. And what they've done is, it's really ingenious. I was just over again this morning. They've grouped it by eras instead of by induction, which they did in. And what they have is all the members have a locker, and it clear plexiglass in front of it. I mean, you can't touch the things in the lockers, so they have all the memorabilia from the people that are in the hall. So, for example, the great triumvirate, the three great British pros at the turn of the century, they're in, they're grouped together. So they have their lockers next to each other. Arnie, Jack, and Gary have their lockers together. Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson have their lockers together. So it's really very, very special. So it's not overwhelming. It seems that it's just right.
I think it's great. I can't wait to see it. There's going to be a little media party that the USGA is throwing over there Wednesday night. So we'll get over there and take a look. I just love golf history. You have been a golf historian for years, and you're very passionate about it. That's why I like having you on the show, because you know a lot about golf history. And let's look at the inductions and who came in. Actually, Dearest Rucker was the host from Hootie and the Blowfish. That was an interesting take. And I was so happy to see Ann Murray, who presented the induction to Sandra Palmer, who played on the LPGA, 19 LPGA Tour titles, including two major championships. And you know, I have my own, you know, experiences with more of the presenters than I do sometimes with the ones getting in. But Ann Murray, Grammy Award-winning Canadian singer, you know, she's a huge golfer. And back in the day when I hosted, you know, the primetime weekly show on the Golf Channel, Ann was one of my guests, and she became one of my interviews that I included in my first book called A Passion for Golf. And she is a good golfer. I interviewed her in Vegas, and she had quite the game. So the fact that she was there and had befriended Sandra Palmer years ago and was there to introduce Sandra Palmer into the hall was very, very special for both women. And it's always great to see them recognize, you know, the women. So obviously Sandra Palmer got in, Beverly Hansen got in. She was a 1950 U.S. Women's Am. And she collected 17 LPGA Tour victories. But I have to say, I thought it was overdue that the LPGA founding 13 got in, Marty. I mean, these 13 women back in 1950 started the LPGA. And without them, there wouldn't be an LPGA. So I was so glad that they got inducted as well. Now, none of them are alive, but these 13 founding women, you know, certainly deserve the recognition and the honor.
And what the early 13 did was they'd go into a town, and they were the corporate structure of the LPGA, not only players, so they'd sell the tickets, they'd do promotion for it, they do the pin settings. I mean, it was, they set everything up themselves. So they're really, they had their hands on everything. And it was really, they did a spectacular job. And the LPGA, you know, it's grown in it slowly. They've had their problems, but they're really on the upswing, thanks to Mike Wann when he was there, who's now the president of the USGA, CEO of the USGA. It was pretty spectacular.
So, Alice, I just want to mention their names because they do deserve the recognition. Alice Bauer, Patty Berg, who I interviewed years ago. That was very, very special. Betty Danoff, Helen Detmeiler, Marlene Bauer-Haig, Helen Hicks, Opal Hill, Betty Jamison, Sally Sessions, Marilyn Smith, Shirley Spork, Louise Suggs, and Babe Zaharias. A lot of times people ask me, Ann, who of all the people you've interviewed in sports through the years, and you know, you and I have been doing this for a long time, who would you have loved to have interviewed? And I always say the two Babes, Babe Zaharias and Babe Ruth. I just think those two would have been, they had so much personality from what I read and, you know, saw in the old clips and old footage that you can, you know, that are archived. And I just really would have loved to have interviewed those two, Babe Zaharias and Babe Ruth.
Let me tell you my two. One, of course, would have been Bobby Jones, who I've done a couple of books on. But Bobby Jones, certainly. And the other would have been Lou Gehrig.
Oh,
and the other half of Ruth.
Right. Oh, gosh, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's so many when you think about it. And, you know, I'll mention my book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. The 12 legends that I chose from that book, Martin, are older, they're great role models, and they're great storytellers. And I think that's what you want when you're doing an interview and when you're sharing, you know, somebody's story, success story, and the ups, the downs. And you want somebody who's willing, first of all, who's very accessible, because a lot of the younger personalities don't want to talk, or it's very hard to get access to because their agents say no, 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 even though some of them would be really good. But these, you know, so-called, the, when you know, when I was in my 20s, and 30, early 30s, I'd interview people like Mickey Mantle and Ted Williams and Hank Aaron and Will Chamberlain, Yogi Berra, Whitey Ford. They were all willing to be on the show and tell their stories.
And they had great, great, great stories. And I just used to love to hear that. So I befriended, as you did, a lot of the older players, like a Byron Nelson, and then, of course, Herb Wind was my dear friend. And I just soak up these stories. And when I used to do a lot of the history stuff on Golf Channel, and we'd be talking at one of the majors, they'd ask a question, a very esoteric question, and somehow I'd pop up with an answer, and we'd go to break, and I'd look at everybody and go, where did I get that from? How do I remember that stuff?
Right.
But I think if you really love it, as you do, and I do, there's a little synapses in your brain that stores this stuff, and then all of a sudden it's called on and you have it. And they're just wonderful stories. Today's players, you know, they go in and there's a group of people that come with them, a trainer, an agent, a massage therapist, a full swing coach, a putting coach. I mean, they have this entourage that goes with them to tournaments, and they're all going on their own plane. You can't get to them.
Right.
And they haven't had a lot of the life experiences. I'll give you one example. Jimmy Demerit, who's in the hall, won the Masters three times, was a very close friend of Ben Hogan's. He was on the tour in the days when they used to travel in a caravan, and they didn't have any money. So they'd stay in these motels, and because they didn't have much money, they didn't have much money for gas. So Demerit would get up early in the morning, and he had this this length of hose. And he'd say to people, he used to tell these stories later, he said, you know what that was? He says, that's a Texas credit card. Somebody would say, what's a Texas credit card? It was a siphon hose. They go to some unsuspecting person staying in the motel. They'd siphon the gas because they couldn't pay for their own gas out of his, it, not one of the players, but just some unsuspecting person staying in the motel. They'd take the gas out of his car, put it in theirs, and they'd be on their way to the next tournament.
Oh, my God. Well, I don't know if they
don't get that today.
I know. You know, definitely don't get that today. They're making, you know, much better money, obviously, and even if they're not winning on the PGA Tour. But, you know, the LPGA founders hopefully didn't have to do that, but they did have to do a lot. They you know, organized the tournaments. They sold the tickets. They promoted the events. They raised the money for the prize money, if there was any, and they played. So, the women deserve so much credit.
And in the early days, especially on the men's tour, sometimes they only paid the top 10 spots. So you could make the cut, or if there was a cut, you could make the cut. You might not make any money, even if you made it to Saturday or Sunday, whenever the tournament was over. Sometimes they'd play a double round on Saturday, play 36 holes.
Well, one of the inductees was also somebody that you were very involved in kind of getting in to the hall. You've been a member at Quaker Ridge in Westchester, New York for 42 years, and Johnny Farrell was the co-head pro with his brother. And he played in the 20s, and boy, he represented the United States on the first three Ryder Cup teams in 1927, 1929, 1931. He accumulated 27 victories during his illustrious career. He placed second in both the Open Championship and the PGA Championship in 1929. How did you kind of initiate Johnny Farrell's induction?
Well, I knew Johnny just in passing when he was pro emeritus at Baltusrol.
And how old would he have been then?
Oh, he was at the 1980 Open at Baltusrol when they presented Nicklaus the trophy for his second win at Baltusrol,
right.
In the Open, in our Open. And he was there. But it's an interesting story. There was a man who, a young boy, was about Johnny's age, was 10 years old, and he used to live on where Saxon Woods is, the public course, not far from around the corner from Quaker. It was a farm that his parents lived and worked on. And at the front entrance to Quaker Ridge is an old one-room schoolhouse that actually was open until the early 50s. And stone building, it's where we store the carts now. And it's the caddy house. And he used to go to school there. So one time he got in a little trouble at school, and they kicked him out. And he saw Tillinghast build the course starting in 1916. He saw them build Quaker, and he was a young fellow, and he got in trouble in school, and they kicked him out of school. He left, or he got mad. And his name was Vic Oberhammer. And he had caddied as a youngster at Quaker, and then the Farrell brothers gave him a job. So here's where I got the stories from, and we'll get to Johnny Farrell in a second. Vic had retired in the middle 70s. I didn't join until the early 80s. But we made Vic an honorary member, and we gave him a spot in the clubhouse, an apartment for he and his wife, Helen, who used to run the ladies' locker room. And they'd come there in the summer. So after dinner, I just loved history, I'd sit down and have Vic tell me stories about the Farrell brothers and the early members, and George Gershwin was a member, and Nathan Strauss, who, you know, built Macy's, and was a big philanthropist. So we would, he would tell me these stories, and it was through that, it was this oral history that was passed along that we finally put into a book for the 100th anniversary of the club. But it was through that we got to know about Farrell. Now, the story about Johnny Farrell was, Johnny Farrell was, I think, 17 or 18 when he was hired as the co-head professional with his older brother by 10 years, Jimmy. And even at about 18 years old, Johnny Farrell was a terrific player, was one of the better players in the New York area. And that was really the fountainhead of golf in America, was really in, you know, St. Andrews, and then Wingfoot came a little bit after Quaker, and all of the clubs, and then out on the island, Shinnecock and National and Maidstone. But it was Farrell who was this terrific player. By the middle 20s, and I'm going to correct something they put in the little program last night about Farrell, just because we did the complete history of the Ryder Cup. The original Ryder Cup was played in 1926, and they don't call it the first one now. It's not the first official, because there was a strike in Britain, and they couldn't get in. But Johnny Farrell was named to the first four Ryder Cups, and he was just a terrific player. So by the middle 20s, he was the best professional in the United States. He won, as you said, 22 times on tour. And then his crowning achievement, and you'll see it in his locker when you go over there, was the 1928 U.S. Open, where he defeated Bobby Jones at Olympia Fields in a 36-hole playoff by one stroke. So it was a big deal. So now he comes back to Westchester. William Rice Hoxter, who was the first president of the club and lived, his house is still there, right off of the first green. We had 150 caddies in these white sweaters with embroidered QR on it, and they had a caddy parade, 75 in a row, this long procession from Hoxter's house, and at the end of the procession was Hoxter, Johnny Farrell, Jimmy Farrell, and the U.S. Open trophy. And they marched to the clubhouse, and there was such a family feeling with the Farrells that Johnny Farrell, and there's a great picture, it was on the front page of the New York Times, Johnny Farrell gave the trophy that he had won in Chicago, the U.S. Open, to Quaker Ridge.
Oh, wow.
It was, you know, the permanent one, for keeping in the clubhouse for the next year. And they had this huge, I mean, there were songs, and I think Gershwin had composed some of the songs. I mean, George Gershwin, you know, getting better than that.
And the trophy's no longer there, though.
No. But what we did was, when we just redid the front part of the clubhouse, what you'll see in the locker is, we got permission from the USGA, it took us a couple of years, to have a replica trophy made. And the cool part is, and you look, when you go Wednesday, you look at the trophy, you have to kind of turn your head a little around. The engraving only goes up to 1928 with the winners, because that's when Johnny Farrell won it. So we have that trophy on loan to the Hall of Fame for the next month. And then
it goes back to
Quaker Ridge.
That's
our trophy.
So now, I met a lot of the grandkids last night. There were seven? Siblings? Is that what I heard?
Yeah, and there were, I think, 30 or 40 members of the family there last night. And most of the boys were involved in golf. Bobby and I guess John Jr. And there's a very interesting thing about how Billy Farrell, who was his son, was named. And Billy Farrell was the pro for 37 years at Stanwich. He was the original in Greenwich, Connecticut. Yep. He was the original pro, and he stayed for until he retired. He was away at a tournament, and originally, and we have a copy of the letter that his wife wrote to Billy about how he was named. And originally, and Johnny was away, and she wanted to name him after Edward, the King of England, who Johnny used to play golf with all the time. Right. And, you know, he was the one that stepped down in the 30s with Wallace Simpson, you know, the great love affair. Yeah. So she was going to name him Edward after, you know, the king. And he had stepped down, and he was the prince then. And Johnny came home and then said, oh, no, we're going to name him William after William Rice Hoxter from Quaker Ridge. There was such a close connection with the family. That's how Billy got to be William. It became Billy Farrell.
Well, it must be tremendously gratifying for you to see, Johnny Farrell get inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. And this is back when these guys wore knickers and played with hickory shafts and, it's just a classic era in golf for sure.
He was such a good player. He taught five presidents how to play golf. He was on, even later in life, he was on the Ed Sullivan Show. And Jones, remember, the Masters didn't start until 34.
Right.
And that was pretty much after his career had ended, his competitive playing career. He was invited to 15 more Masters. He used to just play. I think he only made the cut once.
Right.
But he played in the Masters for years. He and Jones became quite friendly.
Well, also inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame was the late, great Tom Weisskopf. And his win at the Open Championship at Troon in 1973 was one of 16 victories that he accumulated while playing on the PGA Tour. And it was good to see, his induction. I know his family was there and quite sad. I know he passed away from pancreatic cancer pretty suddenly, from what I understand. On a more positive note, Padraig Harrington of Ireland was inducted as well. And Padraig, I have an affection for Padraig Harrington because he's one of the 12 legends in my book, Life on the Green, Lessons in Wisdom from Legends of Golf. He is so honest. He's so insightful. He's such a good interview. I remember, he wanted to be included amongst these 12 legends. Who wouldn't, right? But he was so accessible, and he wanted to kind of continue talking. He didn't get, enough information across to me, and he was getting on a plane and still talking to me. I was recording this interview as he was on this plane getting his seat. So, he's just a really lovely guy, and he's a great role model. His son, Patty, did the introductions. I think he did a great job, but Padraig Harrington has to be one of the nicest guys. And when you hear Rory McIlroy, I asked Rory earlier in the press conference today, how he thought about Padraig Harrington getting into the Hall of Fame and what Padraig meant for golf. And for a small country, Ireland, they have a lot of champion golfers, right? And Rory, waxed poetic about Padraig Harrington and what he meant to Irish golf and how he kind of started that movement where there's so many great champions now from this small country.
Padraig's a terrific guy. I mean, he's a super player, won like three majors, but just a super, super, and honest and fun to be with. And if you'll remember, we gave him the Gold Tee Award several years ago at the Met Golf Writers dinner. And that was one of the best dinners we had. Just his speech was just wonderful. It was good to see him in last night.
So authentic, and he has a great agent. And another thing I love about Padraig is he's very loyal to the people who have helped make him who he is, the champion he is. Pete Cowan, his swing coach, was at the awards last night. His agent, Adrian, was there. Even his dear friend, Paul McGinley, was there, and so it's, and you know, I met his family and the kids. He's just a really great guy.
One of the other things, an interesting connection this year, the Open Championship, what we sometimes call the British Open, is being played at Troon again, and so that's the connection to Weisskopf, and it's also the connection to Arnold, because that was the second British Open Championship, excuse me, that he won, and that's what really. He won in 61, he won in 62, he finished second in 60 at St. Andrews, and that's what revitalized the whole British Open, which we did a whole bunch in the book on, but it was a lot of fun.
Before we move on to Arnold Palmer, American hero, you know, Padraig gave me a lot of time, as I mentioned, for the chapter in Life on the Green, Lessons in Wisdom from Legends of Golf, and something he said to me was just so revealing that he said he not only has nerves when he goes to the first tee, he has fear. And for him to admit that and to kind of share it and say it's very normal, like a lot of people, he said, you know, psychologists say, oh, you shouldn't have fear. He said, it just embrace it. So he talks about how to embrace that fear. And, you know, I can't imagine a three-time major champion, and he continues to be successful on the tour, on the senior tour, you know, being fearful. But, you know, maybe his game won't show up. Maybe he'll shank, you know, off the first tee. I mean, I guess those are the things that go through anybody's mind, no matter how much of a champion you are.
Although they never talked about it much, I used to hear that from Arnie, and I also heard it from Jack, that there was, you had to deal with your fear, and there was trepidation on that first tee, no matter how great a champion you were. And there's no greater champion than Nicklaus. And, you know, when they stood on the tee, they were afraid, but they had to embrace it and get a hold of it and, you know, get over it.
That's interesting to hear that other legends like that, American, you know, Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus, you know, talked about that.
The other one that they'd say he'd sometimes lose 20 pounds in a major championship was Bobby Jones. He was a little on the heavy side, chunky, and he would lose 20 to 30 pounds. He's in a lot of the heat. Now, remember, they're playing in woolen suits with vests and, you know, but still, it was that nervous energy. And Jones had this. So you have the great champions. And our old friend Dave Anderson from the New York Times used to talk about the 6 inches that are most important is the area between your ears. And he used to call it strength of mind. And all of those great champions have had it, and I think a lot of it had to do with how they conquered the fear and how they used it to shape what they were going to do in the championship.
Sure. I mean, the expectation. I mean, they're expected to do so well, and the expectations not only from everybody else watching and your fans, but on the expectation one puts on yourself. I mean, that's a lot to carry when you're playing, you know, under pressure in front of, you know, huge audiences. So I just thought that was very revealing. So, and before we go to Arnold Palmer, Stephan Curry was also honored with the Charlie Seifert Award. And Stephan has a foundation called Underrated Golf. And it's an organization that reaches out to student athletes to provide equity, access, and opportunity. And I just thought that was a really nice touch to the evening. He wasn't here in person, but he sent a really in-depth kind of thank you speech, and it's great that they recognize Stephan Curry, who's a very good golfer as well as a basketball player. He says he might like golf even more than the NBA.
Curry, the reason he wasn't here, believe it or not, was his wife just had their fourth child,
right.
And he was, you know, as good of a three-point shooter he is, and he's probably the best ever in the NBA. He was, although Michael might disagree with that a little. But as good of a three, he's that good as a golfer. I mean, he's legitimately a scratch golfer, and he's lent a lot of his money. Not lent, he's given a lot of his money to the foundation for the golf foundation that he's started.
He's from a really great golf family as well. The father taught them how to play when they were really young. And Seth Curry, I saw this year and last year at the BMW Charity Pro-Am just last week, his younger brother plays. So it's nice to see that Stefan's using his influence to help provide more access and equity to student athletes. All right, let's talk about the book. How many How many have you done? These coffee table books. I know I've carried a lot of them back from various tournaments. The Ryder Cup book, it only weighed 40 pounds. So what book is this? You've published a lot of books through our friendship.
In the big book series, these large coffee table books, they're 11 by 14. This is the seventh in that series, although we've done this is my 39th book. So
right.
It's
and Arnold Palmer, the king, obviously an American hero for sure. And, you know, I got to know him in New York, but when he would come through town, I'd interview him. And then obviously down in Orlando, I was one of the original hosts on the Golf Channel, and he was one of the founders of the Golf Channel. And then finally, just months before he passed away, Martin, I went to La Trobe. It was right after the 2016 U.S. Open at Oakmont. And there he was. He was struggling, I could tell. He could hardly get up to greet me. I told him not to get up. But yet he got up like a gentleman and shook my hand and spent 15 minutes talking to me. And I had him sign a couple books. And he was signing memorabilia before I got there. And I heard he continued to sign for hours every day until literally, you know, his final days. And you can't say enough about Arnold Palmer's influence on golf and really on all of sport.
Oh, absolutely. The way these books are set up, and especially with the Arnold books a little bit different, is we do these essays up front on different aspects of the player's life. So we've done two books on Mr. Hogan, Byron Nelson, Bobby Jones, Jack, and then we did the Ryder Cup book. But we have these essays. But every time we looked at one thing to write about for, and I'd get some terrific writers who knew certain aspects of Arnold to do this. I did a couple of those up front pieces. But what we do is every time we'd look under one rock, we found two more rocks. So instead of five or six essays up front, there were 21 of them. And then the back of the book is set up of the back two-thirds is the game day stories of all of the big events in his life, win and lose. Those heartbreaking losses at the U.S. Open, the one in San Francisco, the one at the Country Club in Boston, and there are over 300 photographs in the book. We print the books; they're very expensive to do in Italy. It's available at Barnes & Noble, BarnesandNoble.com, also on Amazon, we're already into a second printing. So it's pretty exciting. And there are four big gatefolds in the book, one on putting by Brad Faxon and analyzing Arnold's kind of crazy putting stance and stroke. His Jimmy McLean did an analysis of his full swing with that big helicopter finish to hold off, hopefully from hooking it too much. One on the Ryder Cup in the back of the book that I did, on the seven Ryder Cups that Arnold played in, and one of the gatefolds folds out to 5.5 feet. I mean, that you don't want to get caught in the wind with the book. And then we did one on Tiger, who won Arnold's event 8 times. He won the Bay Hill tournament. So it's a big book. It's 372 pages, and just so that you can have your pay your extra luggage charges, it's 8 pounds. It's kind of heavy. So the joke we have is it's a lot to you can't digest it all at once. If you get tired reading it, you can always work out with it for a while.
You can lift weights with it and build some muscles. But yeah, Arnold had such influence on the game and on other players. In fact, Tom Watson in his chapter in my book talks about how he would just sit and watch Arnold conduct himself. And not so much his swing. Maybe he did watch his swing, but he'd sit on the range just when he was young, Tom Watson, and he'd watch Arnold interact with the fans and sign autographs and smile. He had really the most charismatic smile of any personality that I can remember in sport. And he was nice to everybody. You could be the president or a janitor, and he treated everybody with respect, which I just so adored about Arnold Palmer.
Arnold really was very, very giving. One of the things that he always impressed on the pros, on the fellow professionals on the tour, when the young pros would come out, he always told them to take their time in signing the autographs. And if you've ever seen an Arnold Palmer autograph, beautiful penmanship. So he always told them, you don't scrawl it. These people want a little piece of you, and that's what you're giving them. He also, Arnold had an interesting thing. I'm sure he gave away plenty of money in his life, You never heard about that. But what you did see, and we're even a recipient of that through the our Dave Morris Scholarship at Columbia Journalism School. If you thought what you were doing was valuable and worthwhile, he'd help you out. So we funded that scholarship we have at Columbia, at the Graduate School of Journalism, which is the best in the world. We funded it with three outings. Arnold appeared at the first one. Nick Faldo was at the second one. And the third one, they were all spaced about 5 years apart, was it Quaker Ridge. And when I called him up and I said, would you like to play again? Because he was coming to the dinner that night. And he said, well, Martin, my game is not, he was older then, my game is not for show anymore. And there was this pause, and he goes, but I'll come for lunch. And I said, that's all we want. We just want you there. You know,
That's a great story. Martin Davis, always a pleasure to connect. All the best with Arnold Palmer, American Hero. You can get it, actually, where you can get my book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. All the best. I'm sure I'll see you soon and give my love to your golden retriever named Arnie. Julia Pine, Director of Championship Communications and Content for the USGA, joins us. Good morning, Julia. How are you?
Hey, Ann. How are you?
Good. How's Pinehurst, North Carolina, treating you?
It's great. The course looks fantastic, and I am sitting in the media center.
I love it. You work so hard, and you cover so many tournaments in a year, and I want to get into that in a second. But to talk about the various departments of the USGA that have recently moved to Pinehurst.
Yeah, so we're calling this home now. I personally am calling it home, but there's quite a few departments that have completely relocated to Golf House Pinehurst, as we're calling it. Our equipment standards team, because our new test center is down here in Pinehurst. Our green section team, there's a little bit better weather for them to work on their world here in North Carolina than there was in New Jersey. Our Open Championships team, which runs all of our Opens, as well as a few folks from my world, communications, marketing, partnerships, et cetera.
So what a great transition for you if you like warm weather, right?
Absolutely. The winters here are a little nicer than Far Hills, New Jersey.
And it's such a charming town, Pinehurst, for sure. I can't wait to get up there today. But now Pinehurst has become an anchor site. Can you talk about, you know, this whole new philosophy about anchor sites for U.S. Open venues?
Yeah, so we have three anchor sites, and this will be the first time we're actually playing a U.S. Open on a named anchor site since we formulated this philosophy. So those are Pinehurst, Oakmont, where we're going to be next year for the U.S. Open, and Pebble Beach. And the process here is really, how can we supercharge our U.S. Opens? How can we be better for fans, for players, for viewers? And the things that we're able to do with a facility when they know they have that commitment from us that we'll be back for a U.S. Open every 5 or 6 years, it just unlocks so much for us. And it's everything from here at Pinehurst, we've been able to put in underground water and power so that fans have a better experience. They've rebuilt the locker room here at Pinehurst. That's something the club did, but they wouldn't have put in that sort of investment if they didn't know that we'd be back with that sort of frequency for a championship that, you know, makes them a lot of money. We look at Oakmont, we're going to be able to do things with the land there. We're going to be able to build things there that we just couldn't do if we didn't have that sense of, hey, we're going to have a U.S. Open here that frequently.
Right. So it will be at Oakmont next year, Shinnecock 2026, back to Pebble Beach in 27, Wingfoot in 2028, and then it's back in Pinehurst in 2029, and it's already locked in for Pinehurst in 2035, 2041, and 2047.
Exactly. And that's why we can make those types of, you know, financial commitments to really build this place to be an effective and efficient and, again, supercharged U.S. Open.
Right, right, right. And by doing all this with the USGA's, you know, move down there, as you say, in those various departments, I read where the economic impact of the presence of the USGA in Pinehurst exceeds, what, $2 billion to the state of North Carolina?
Yeah, our partnership with the state is unbelievable. They've been such good partners and friends, and so has Pinehurst Resort, who let us build our new house right on their property. You know, Golf House Pinehurst, both the administrative side, which hosts our test center and all of our offices, as well as the public-facing side. We are open to the public now. It is the World Golf Hall of Fame. It is the USGA Museum and Experience, all of that is right across the street from Pinehurst Number 2. So pretty remarkable that they were able to give us that piece of property.
I'm looking forward to seeing the World Golf Hall of Fame. I know it recently moved back to Pinehurst from St. Augustine, Florida, right?
Exactly. It's a coming home for the World Golf Hall of Fame, which originally was based here. This Monday, we're going to have the 50th anniversary of the World Golf Hall of Fame induction ceremony. But we were able to transport what we thought was the most special part of what was down in St. Augustine, which was the locker experience. All of the inductees have a locker. Those who are still living helped us shape what was in their locker. It's everything from golf memorabilia, like clubs and balls and gloves, to personal items. You know, Betsy King has a Bible in there. That means a lot to her. Some people have baseball gloves because they love other sports. So walking through that locker experience is really special. You can spend hours getting lost up there.
I'm excited to go over there and check it out. And I went through the inductees who's being inducted. And as far as the presenters go, you're going to have Jim Nance, Nancy Lopez, Michelle Wee West, Peter Jacobson. Those will be a few of the presenters in the induction ceremony. And I hear Darius Rucker is going to host it.
Yeah, he's the MC. We're really excited to have Darius. He's just so passionate about golf, all he does to give back, especially in the amateur and women's game with his event down in South Carolina. But personally, I'm really excited. It's long overdue that the LPGA founders will be inducted. And they've done a really nice thing, as you said, having Michelle Wee to Nancy Lopez to the founders, really tying together, you know, three really important generations of female golfers as we honor all that the founders did.
Yeah, and I know you just spent, a long time at the U.S. Women's Open at Lancaster. I say a couple of days. You're there probably, you know, weeks in advance. But what a great win for Yuka Saso. I was so pleased for her because, you know, speaking of the Founders, I was able to play with her in the Founders Cup, you know, Pro-Am for 9 holes. And, boy, she can hit the ball. And I was just so pleased. She's such a sweet person.
She's so humble. She's so generous. You know, we got to know her really well. Actually, even before her win in 2021, she was a quarterfinalist at the Girls Junior in 2019, if you can believe that, because she's still so young. She just hits the ball so well. Her game really seems to be made for U.S. Opens. You know, those are her only 2 wins. It's kind of remarkable she hasn't won more. But I told her on Thursday, I said, "You're walking with a different kind of confidence." And she said, "Is that a good thing?" And so on Sunday when she won, I said, "I think it's a good thing."
Right. And I thought Minji Lee might pull it out. I was able to, you know, play the front nine with her at the Founders Cup. But boy, she's so strong in those major championships as well. But she couldn't do it. She couldn't close it out.
Yeah, another U.S. Open champion. She won here in the Pinehurst area in 22 at Pine Needles. And I think she was certainly the favorite going into Sunday. Obviously didn't have her best stuff. But one Minji story I will tell is she and Yuka are pretty good friends. I think she feels like a bit of an older sister to Yuka. They both live in Dallas, play out of the same club. And even though Minji had that tough day on Sunday, she stood in the back of the room during Yuka's winner's press conference, standing with Yuka's dad, which I just thought was really classy of her and just showed kind of her love for her friend, even when she herself had a tough day.
Right. No, that is, these women are extraordinary. They're just such wonderful people, just lovely on and off the course. And you interview them all the time. Did anything surprise you coming out of that U.S. Women's Open this year from some of the interviews you conducted?
I think Astrix Tally was maybe the most fun interview of the week a few times, just at 15 years old. So much poise, but also still 15. She's not too polished that you feel like it's manufactured. She had an unbelievable first round on Thursday. Obviously was kind of lighting up the media center. She's part of our new U.S. National Junior team, so we've gotten to know her through one of the camps we had already, and some of our coaches have worked with her. But at 15 years old, to be on that sort of stage, she had some tough days Friday, Saturday, still did media when asked. So I think overall she can walk out of that with so many positives. But the way she was speaking about the golf course, about signing autographs, she said a teenage boy asked for her number as she walked off the green. It was just sort of a breath of fresh air, but also a reminder of what makes the U.S. Open special is that openness.
Right, exactly. And they're so mature at such a young age. You know, golf teaches you so much at such an early age that these players surprise you, you know, for their maturity at such a young age. Well, moving back to the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, does the trophy already have Scottie Scheffler's name on it?
You know, he hasn't been able to do it yet, so I know Scottie wants that national championship trophy. But, you know, Pinehurst is proven very difficult in the past. You know, we've only had ever in our three U.S. Opens here, five bogey-free rounds. So it's going to play tough, you know, a lot of the ways that Lancaster did. I think one of the things we really appreciated was the way the women spoke about it. You know, this is a U.S. Open that should be tough. And I think the men will walk into Pinehurst knowing that this is a tougher U.S. Open venue. You're not going to have a lot of birdie opportunities. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see who kind of walks away with that trophy.
It's hard to fire at those pins with those domed greens, you know, with the fall-off areas. And they're just so hard. Those greens are brutal, you know?
Yeah, John Bodenhammer likes to call them upside-down cereal bowls. And, you know, he's not that far off on a few of them.
Yeah, and I hear they all went to Bermuda grass from Bent. That's the difference this year.
It is, yeah. So we're interested in how they play. We've obviously had some players come out here over the past few weeks. We've gotten some feedback. Wyndham Clark was out here for media day. It was his first time seeing the course. But since then, you know, that's been about 5 weeks. It's definitely playing a little firmer and faster.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Pashley, the president of Pinehurst Resort, he said, Pinehurst number two, we feel that the golf course is always close to U.S. Open ready. He says in quotes, we don't have to grow up the rough. We don't have to narrow the fairways. We focus on firming up the conditions and making sure it's fast. He says, now with Bermuda grass greens instead of bent grass greens, we can't wait to see how the Donald Ross greens perform under U.S. Open conditions. And I guess the Bermuda, going to Bermuda makes it more playable longer in the year. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how these guys who are, you know, the scores have just been so low this year on the PGA Tour. But at the U.S. Open, it's always so difficult. So it'll be interesting to see how they approach, you know, their strategy when it comes to playing Pinehurst.
Absolutely. And one of the other changes, I mean, Tom Pashley nailed it. But the other thing is that native area has really evolved since 2014, you know, back 10 years ago, there were sort of clumps of that native wiregrass, but there was a lot of exposed sand in between. Since then, that has really filled out. There's definitely a few different plants. We've brought in some wiregrass of our own over the last year and a half. So you're going to get much more penalized for missing the fairway than maybe you did in 2014.
Julia, give my audience a sense of your schedule, because even though you're now living and you're based in Pinehurst, you're very rarely there, I'm sure, with all the USGA tournaments that you cover.
Yeah, so we run 15 national championships. It is nice to have this home game for some of us, though. So we're home for at least 2 weeks right now for the U.S. Open. But, yeah, we just got back from Lancaster. You know, me personally, I don't go to all 15, but certainly make it to 7 or 8 championships a year, some of our marquee events. So not long after the U.S. Open, we'll be headed to Newport for the Senior Open, a really special venue for the USGA. It's where their first ever championship was held about 130 years ago. We've got a really great Junior Am schedule at Oakland Hills this year, another classic venue. We've got the Women's Am at Southern Hills, the U.S. Am at Hazeltine. So we're making our way across the country as we always do, but really a great lineup of venues.
Are you a golfer yourself, Julia?
Not as good as the golf that I witness.
Sure.
I watch such good golf, but certainly living here in Pinehurst, playing more golf than I ever have. And, you know, we even have access to things like the Cradle, which is just such an accessible way for playing golf, even getting 9 in after work. So it's been fun living down here.
My thanks to Martin Davis, to Julia Pine, and to Mike Goodsell in production. As the great Bobby Jones once said, golf is the closest game to the game we call life. You get bad breaks from good shots, you get good breaks from bad shots, but you have to play the ball where it lies. Love that quote. Have a great day. Be kind, be safe, and I look forward to talking with you next time right here on Sports Interview with Anne LaGorrie.